Thank you, Andy, for those gracious words. I'm really grateful that you just didn't introduce me as simple. I'm grateful for that. You know, this is the very first time since 1995 that I have been introduced on this program by someone other than Denver. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. When Denver told me a few months ago that the lectures would be on the book of 1 Corinthians, I was very pleased to hear that. But I was also a little bit concerned. I said, that's wonderful, just so long as I'm not assigned to speak on the not under bondage passages in chapter 7. He just kind of laughed like he did just now. A few weeks later, I received my assignment, and lo and behold, out of the 437 verses in the book of 1 Corinthians, guess what section I was given? Believe me, I was not pulling a Brer Rabbit act. You remember Brer Rabbit told Brer Fox, you can do whatever you want to me. You can pull my ears off. You can pull my tail off, but please don't throw me in that briar patch. That's exactly what he wanted. He got thrown in the briar patch, and he said, I was born and bred in the briar patch. That's exactly what Brer Rabbit wanted. This is not exactly what I wanted, but I'm thankful for the invitation to speak on this important subject. The topic for this hour is separation and divorce. And the section of scripture that we're going to be looking at is 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 10 through 16. But before we read about what Paul says, I want us to look at two things. I want us to consider the terms separation and the term divorce. What is the difference? By and large, none. Now, they are different words, and yet they carry basically the same idea. Both terms, separation and divorce, denote a distinct apartness. The only difference is one of nuance. Divorce carries with it the concept of legal finality, a termination of a marriage of which Jesus gave just one exception in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9. Whereas the term separation is unencumbered with any judicial baggage. Other than that difference, the end result is exactly the same. And that is the husband and wife are no longer together. Now, some seem to see a little bit of affability, some comfort in the statement, oh, we're not divorced, we're only separated. But the fact remains, they are no longer living together as husband and wife. And so this claim that we sometimes hear, we're not divorced, we're only separated, is not something to be pleased with or offers any real comfort. Unless such a statement is made by a brother or sister in Christ with heaven's endorsement, 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 15. Now let's turn and read our text together, 1 Corinthians 7, 10 through 16. And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. Let not the wife depart from her husband, but, and if she depart, let her remain unmarried, or be reconciled to her husband. And let not the husband put away his wife, but to the rest speak I, not the Lord. If any brother hath a wife that believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let him not put her away. And the woman which hath an husband that believeth not, and if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now are they holy. But if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace. For what knowest thou, O wife, whether thou shalt save thy husband? Or how knowest thou, O man, whether thou shalt save thy wife? This is widely considered to be a difficult section of the book of 1 Corinthians. And reams have been printed in order to explain these seven verses. Much of what has been printed is fallacious. A lot of false teaching has spewed forth in print and from pulpit by those searching for a loophole to pacify those who are in unholy unions or who plan to be married unscripturally. And so the purpose of this study is dual in nature. First, to dismantle the false doctrine that is taught from this passage. And secondly, to establish the truth of what the Bible is teaching here. Now, in order to accomplish this, questions from each verse will be posed to the Apostle Paul. And therefore, our study will take on the format of an interview with him. Let's begin our interview with this question. And it's an important one. It's one that we need to understand. Paul, who are the married? Verse 10 begins, "And unto the married I command." Now, attempts have been made to limit Paul's use of the word married here with references to only Christian marriages. But notice, Paul does not in any way make this distinction. He uses the all-inclusive phrase, the married, apart from any qualifier. In Matthew chapter 5 and verse 32, and chapter 19 and verse 9, Jesus certainly did not restrict his teaching on marriage, divorce, and remarriage to only Christians. Instead, in both passages, he too used another all-inclusive term, whosoever. Whosoever. Paul certainly must not be accused of teaching anything that would contradict what Jesus, the Son of God, taught, regardless of what the subject matter may be. Now, regarding this question, who are the married? Brother Roy Deaver said this: "The plain fact of the matter is that verses 10 and 11 relate to all marriages, not just marriages of believers to believers. Paul speaks plainly unto the married. What married? Answer, all the married. Believers married to believers, believers married to unbelievers, and unbelievers married to unbelievers. There can be no justification whatsoever for attempting to make the married in this reading to mean some of the married. The law which is dealt with in verses 10 and 11 relate to all marriages." Now, our next question is this: Paul, are you even inspired to discuss this subject? Because verse 10 continues, "Unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband." So the answer Paul gives is an unequivocal yes. He is inspired to speak on this. Now, please don't misinterpret what Paul is saying here. And don't draw the conclusion that somehow Paul is saying he was not personally speaking by inspiration when he wrote these words by inspiration. "Yet not I, but the Lord." All Paul is saying is, I have gone from giving inspired advice regarding the unmarried and the widows back in verses 8 and 9 to commanding. So what Paul says here cannot be sloughed off or in the least bit disregarded. And furthermore, his words were not just for that day and time, but for all time. And what Paul teaches here is bolstered by what Jesus had already taught in Mark chapter 10 and in Luke 16. In other words, what Paul commands here has already been commanded by Christ. Therefore, it was inspired and it was infallible. Without quibble, Paul was inspired. 1 Corinthians 2, verses 10 and following. Thus, what he said, what he wrote, must strictly be adhered to, because to reject the words of Paul or any of the apostles is to reject the words of Jesus Christ himself. And when Paul says, "Unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord," he is saying that both he and the Lord are issuing these orders. He is saying, it's not just me, an apostle, saying this, but also the Lord. So, instead of inspiration being denied, just the opposite is taking place. Inspiration is being underscored, and underscored boldly. A third question. Paul, is separation ever justified? Verse 11. "But and if she depart, let her remain unmarried, or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife." We see in verse 10 that marriage is for life. It is a contract a man and woman make in the eyes of God that he himself binds them to. And it is for better or worse, for richer or poorer, in sickness and in health, until death dissolves the marriage. And yet, Paul appears to say that there is justifiable cause for separation. Not divorce, but separation in certain situations. And I think that's evident by his inspired wording. "But and if she depart." Along these lines, my father has written, "By leaving her husband, a wife, even though she doesn't have anything to do with another man, is being untrue to her responsibility to her husband and to what the Lord demands of her as a wife. The husband, of course, has corresponding responsibilities to the wife and to God. Therefore, leaving one's partner is a very serious step. Surely, certain situations arise where such a step could be taken without sin. For instance, if one's life or the life of a child were in danger. But in such an event, the wife or husband must remain unmarried or else go back to their partner." There have been many wives who desperately wanted to save their marriage, and yet nonetheless were forced to separate from their husbands due to physical abuse. This abuse could have been spawned by the use of alcohol or drugs. There may have been no catalyst involved other than just plain old meanness on the part of the husband. Yet fearing for her life or the life of her children or for both, she departs. Now, who could impugn such a decision as that? Neither the Lord nor Paul faults a wife who is forced to take such a step, provided she remained true to the divine stipulations of the separation, which are either she remains unmarried or she returns to her husband. There are no other options. And brethren, this is why marriage is such a serious thing. And what is applicable to the wife is also applicable to the husband. Now, as we proceed in our interview with the Apostle Paul, let's now pose this question. Paul, are you putting words in the Lord's mouth? Look at verse 12. But to the rest speak I, not the Lord. Now again, from all we know about the authority of the Lord's apostles, coupled with Bible verbal plenary inspiration, Paul is moved to answer this silly question with a resounding no. Such a charge as that is ludicrous. It has been argued and argued weekly that Paul was prefacing his forthcoming words as his personal ideas. And some translations have contributed to that twisted thought, by the way. And once more, I want to quote my dad. In effect, Paul would be saying, I have been inspired up to this point, but now I'm going to turn the inspiration off because I want to inject some of my personal ideas. And then he explains, Paul is simply declaring that what he is about to say is something the Lord did not reveal while on earth. And so the thrust of what Paul is saying is the Lord did not deal specifically with the questions that the Corinthians were asking him at that time. And shame on those who have relegated this verse and the ones to follow as simply Paul's natural ideas in place of supernatural inspiration. When will the modernist out there finally absorb the truth that what Paul wrote are the very words of God? It's not that they can't, it's that they won't. Now this query. Paul, who or what is the rest? Verse 12. But to the rest speak I. It has been advanced by more than a few that the rest refers to mixed marriages. That is, a Christian married to a non-Christian. If that is the case, then the married in verse 10 refers exclusively to Christian marriages. And I remind you, Paul offers no such qualifier that indicates he means only Christian marriages back in verse 10. He simply states the married, pardon me, which includes mixed marriages. Now, regarding the idea that the rest means mixed marriages, Roy Deaver had this to say too. This is pure assumption. Paul said in verse 1 that he would be dealing with the matters about which they had asked. He had discussed some of these in verses 1 through 9. Now, he says, he's going to deal with the rest. Did Paul do what he indicated he was going to do? Yes. Then what did he do? He discussed three things. One, the marriage of a Christian man to a non-Christian woman who was content to dwell with her husband. Two, the marriage of a Christian woman who was married to a non-Christian man who was content to dwell with his wife. And three, the marriage of a Christian to a non-Christian who was not content to dwell with the Christian. If Paul said he was going to discuss the rest, and if Paul proceeded to discuss these three matters indicated, and if Paul did what he said he was going to do, then the rest must refer to the rest of the questions which the Corinthian brethren had asked about. The rest of the problems. Now, although the married in verse 10 means all marriages, the Lord did not specifically address these questions that the Corinthians were asking Paul, and thus equipped with apostolic authority and the impossibility of contravening anything the Lord had already taught on the subject of marriage in general, he begins to answer the rest of their questions. Questions that Jesus did not deal with when he was here upon the earth. Now, with the rest of these questions before us, let us now ask, Paul, are you saying it's not a sin to remain with an unbelieving partner? The balance of verse 12 and then verse 13 says, if any brother hath a wife that believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let him not put her away. And the woman which hath an husband that believeth not, and if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. That's as plain as it can be. As long as the unbelieving partner is willing to stay, the Christian has no right to leave. He or she has no grounds for divorce, that is put away in verse 12, nor to separate, that is not leave in verse 13. So Paul's teaching is unmistakably clear. Marriage of a non-Christian to a Christian does not defile the husband and wife relationship. A Christian does not have the right to divorce or separate from their non-Christian mate. And furthermore, Brother Wayne Jackson concurs. He says, mere religious incompatibility is not a cause for dissolving a marriage. Marriage is a divine institution for the entire human family, commencing with Adam and Eve. Brother Earl Edwards expands on this a little bit. He says this passage presupposes that a marriage between two non-believers who are marriageable is recognized by God. In fact, the family was instituted by God in Eden long before there was a church. And so Paul's answer is clear. It's not a sin to remain with an unbelieving partner. The next question. Paul, do verses 10 through 13 show that Matthew 19:9 is a covenant passage? We know what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9. Whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery. What do we mean by covenant passage? It means that the passage under consideration only applies to those within the covenant. In other words, it is argued that the Lord's words in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9 only applies to Christians who are married to Christians. That it does not apply to mixed marriages or marriages in which neither partner is a Christian. Now, if this is true, it wouldn't matter how many times a person married or divorced prior to becoming a Christian. And also the reasons for doing so wouldn't matter either. Such a position as this makes a mockery out of marriage and a farce out of the Lord's teachings. Those who hold that Matthew 19:9 is a covenant passage overlook a very important word that Jesus used, the word whosoever. It necessarily means anyone. Whosoever is an all-inclusive word, and it excludes no one, regardless if they are a Christian or not. There is no basis for making Matthew 19 and verse 9 a so-called covenant passage. It is made one only because of a gross mishandling of our text. And again, it is argued that verses 10 and 11 deal only with two Christians that are married to each other. Paul doesn't hint at that whatsoever. It is a grand assumption. It's made by those who want to make Matthew 19 and verse 9 only apply to Christians. And based on that unwarranted assumption, they say that since verses 10 and 11 deal with Christians being married to Christians, and since Paul said Jesus dealt with this kind of union, and since verses 12 and 13 deal with a Christian being married to a non-Christian, and Paul says Jesus did not deal with this kind of union, and since Christ in Matthew 19:9 discusses marriage, divorce, and remarriage, then it must be that Matthew 19:9 only applies to 1 Corinthians 7, 10, and 11 with Christian marriages. That's their argument. And that Matthew 19:9 does not apply to the mixed marriages of 1 Corinthians 7, 12, and 13. You see, the whole argument stands on the assumption that the married, in verse 10, are Christians married to Christians. The problem is, this makes Matthew 19:9 bereft of any universal application, and you have Paul contradicting what Jesus taught, which is an impossibility. And so Paul blares out in siren tones, "No, in no way do my words in 1 Corinthians 7, 10 through 13 show that Matthew 19:9 is a covenant passage." Another question. Paul, how do you define separation and divorce? Four times in this passage, he uses the term depart. He uses put away twice and the word leave once. Do these words describe divorce or merely separation? As I said at the outset, the end result of both is the same. That is, the husband and wife are no longer together. The word depart in the King James Version is translated from the Greek word charizo. Earl Edwards says this, "But it evidently is a synonym of divorce here, since the woman who does it is unmarried, according to verse 11. Gary Workman says, charizo can embrace both separation and divorce. But unmarried in verse 11 does not necessarily have to mean divorced. It can simply mean unmarried to someone else, can it? In other words, separated. And since charizo can refer to either separation or divorce, it serves, I think, to emphasize how God does not want any scripturally married couple to part, either by separation or by dissolution of the marriage itself, divorce. But I want you to notice this. Paul also uses the phrase put away twice in verses 11 and 12, as well as the term leave in verse 13. Both of these are translated from the Greek word aphamai. And unlike charizo, which is ambiguous, this word, aphamai, has only one meaning, and this is it. In a legal sense, divorce. In fact, put away is rendered divorce in the New King James Version, the New International Version, the Revised Standard Version, and the New Revised Standard Version. Now, why did the Apostle Paul use two different Greek words in our text? Even though our English translations don't show us this usage, I think nonetheless that now that it's been pointed out to us, it ought to impress on husbands and wives that both actions, divorce and separation, are forbidden by God. That is, unless the exception of fornication is present, according to Matthew 19:9, resulting in a divorce, or some radical reason, such as physical endangerment, is involved, resulting in separation. But even then, the only scriptural alternatives are reconciliation or remaining unmarried to another person. Verse 11. Paul, how is an unbelieving mate sanctified? Look at verse 14. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now are they holy. Evidently, some at Corinth were teaching if one of the marriage partners was not a Christian, then the marriage was unholy and invalid. Paul says just the opposite. That is, the unbeliever has been sanctified by the believer. Now, the word sanctified, as it is used here, does not mean redeemed. It doesn't mean forgiven. Paul is not saying just because a non-Christian marries a Christian that that puts him or her in a saved state. So what does Paul mean? How is a non-Christian marriage partner sanctified? They are sanctified in the sense of being made a suitable marriage partner. A non-Christian in a scriptural marriage to a Christian has God's approval. It has the smiles of heaven down upon it. Now, for the sake of time, I refer you to the book and the good comments that are made there by our brethren. But let's now go to verse 15, because this is the briar patch that I referred to in my introduction. Let's ask two questions. Number one, Paul, what is your privilege? And are you allowing another ground for remarriage? Verse 15, but if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace. Centuries ago, the Roman Catholic Church concocted a so-called Pauline privilege. And yet Paul would not, could not, and did not give another ground for divorce and remarriage in this verse. And how sad it is that many members of the church have swallowed this fatal doctrine in a futile attempt to defend their marriage, divorce, and remarriage dilemmas. So far, Paul has taught that the Christian is not to leave the non-Christian mate. But what if the non-Christian decides to depart on their own accord? Paul says, let him depart. The brother or sister, that is the Christian partner, is not under bondage in such cases. An Everest of false teaching has been done based on a dishonest and biased interpretation of verse 15. Even people with a cursory knowledge of what Jesus taught in Matthew chapter 5 and chapter 19 can understand that Paul is not giving another exception to divorce and remarriage here. Now, regarding the non-existent Pauline privilege, Robert Taylor says the following. Basically, it adds another ground to Matthew 19:9. It amounts to an apostolic countermanding of what the Christ taught. It makes a shambles of except if and only if, in Matthew 19:9, if desertion of the believer by the unbeliever provides another ground for divorce and remarriage, then the grammatical force of except it be for fornication in Matthew 19:9 is shattered forevermore. Let's look at the much maligned phrase, not under bondage. The word bondage cannot mean the marriage bond. The Greek simply won't allow it. If you listen carefully, read along in the book regarding what Roy Deaver said about the Greek word translated bondage here. This is the Greek word didoulotai, perfect past indicative, third person singular of the word doulou, in three passages where the bond referred to is unquestionably the marriage bond. 1 Corinthians 7, 27 and 39, Romans 7 and verse 2. The word used is dio, not doulou. In this very chapter, in referring to the marriage bond, Paul twice uses dio, but in verse 15, he uses a different word. And he says, this fact is significant. And he goes on to say, the word doulou in some form occurs 133 times in the New Testament, and not a single time, unless 1 Corinthians 7:15 is the exception, does it refer to the marriage bond. This word refers to slavery. The Christian, the deserted Christian, does not stand and, in fact, never did stand under that kind of bondage. This very construction, the perfect tense verb, makes it impossible for the bondage under consideration to mean the marriage bond. The perfect tense means is not now, and in fact never has been, in this kind of bondage referred to, but the deserted Christian has been in the marriage bondage. Therefore, the bondage referred to here is not and could not be the marriage bond. Now, knowing that, what is the practicality of what Paul says in verse 15? The late lamented Bill Jackson says this, in some cases, the unbeliever is determined to depart. The unbeliever may lay down this challenge, you leave the Lord or I will leave you. No doubt with this challenge or by some other intolerance of the faith of the Christian, the unbeliever intends to leave. Paul has stated, if this be the case, let him depart. The believer is not so bound or enslaved or tied to that person that effort should be put forth to force his or her remaining, and most certainly not so bound or enslaved that for the sake of the companion, the Christian then gives up his or her faith. Remember, let him depart. You are not obligated to force the companion to remain. Once again, I want to quote my father. If the unbelieving partner leaves, the believer is to let them go. Not under bondage does not mean that the believer is released from the marriage vow so that he or she may remarry, but simply that they are not required to compel their partner to remain or return. They are guiltless before God in respect of the separation, but they may not marry another. Notice how verse 15 ends. It concludes by reminding, but God hath called us to peace. It would be unfitting for the Christian mate to coerce the non-Christian to remain. There are times when a Christian has done all they can peaceably to stave off a separation. But if the non-Christian is determined to leave, the Christian then follows the course of peace and allows, that is, lets him or her depart. And this action gives neither party the right to divorce and remarry, regardless of how many preachers today says it does. Undoubtedly, there are a host of reasons why a separation in a mixed marriage may come about, but there is only one whereby the wronged party may divorce the guilty party and remarry another innocent party, and that is fornication. Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9. That is the universal teaching of our Lord, and it cannot be changed, ever. Furthermore, Paul did not make an exception to it in 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 15. So he is the first one to refute any privilege attributed to him. And Paul would intensely argue that his and the Lord's teaching on this subject is precisely the same. And the final question in our interview is this. Paul, is there any hope for mixed marriages? And he responds by saying, absolutely. Let's read verse 16. For what knowest thou, O wife, whether thou shalt save thy husband? Or how knowest thou, O man, whether thou shalt save thy wife? Let me tell you, those are words of hope. And Paul is reinforcing everything he has said about marriage between a believer and an unbeliever. It is the hope of eventual conversion to Christ that further justifies keeping the marriage together. Even if the unbelieving mate departs, the Christian may still be able to exert an influence that would lead to their conversion, to their ultimate salvation. You know, the Apostle Peter alludes to that possibility in 1 Peter 3, verses 1 and following. And so a person who is in such a marriage ought not to think that their Christian influence is ineffective, because both Paul and Peter declare there is a reason for hope. A godly wife or husband may very well be the critical factor in bringing their unbelieving mate to Christ and ultimately having their company in heaven above. 1 Corinthians 7:16. Lends great encouragement to all who are married to non-Christians. Separation and divorce have destroyed countless marriages and has adversely affected countless innocent children. And the only remedy for all this sadness is an understanding of and an adherence to what Jesus and his apostles taught on the vital subject of separation, marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And may all people everywhere study and practice what the New Testament clearly teaches on this subject, because only then can marriage be protected and nourished, and separation and divorce eliminated. Thank you very much.